Hi everyone, welcome to Baby Steps Nutrition, a podcast that focuses on nutrition, health, and wellness for families of children of all ages and stages. I'm your host, Argavon Neil Forouche, a pediatric dietitian and mom of two young children. My goal is to bring you impactful information that you can apply every day in a simplified, practical form to make life easier. Now let's get into today's conversation. The pandemic has had a pronounced impact on mental health. There is no doubt that mental health awareness is here to stay, and everyone to different degrees have suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, whether directly or indirectly related to COVID-19. The feelings of loss, grief, and isolation are felt and talked about more than ever before. Eric Christensen is a director, producer, editor, and filmmaker. After experiencing a life-altering event, followed by months of alcohol and drugs to cope, Eric turned to the power of storytelling and story-making to deliver messages of hope and resilience. To say I've been eagerly anticipating this conversation is a major understatement. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you. I appreciate it, and I'm so excited. The topics that we've had in our pre-interview and everything, I'm very excited to get to the core of this. So thank you so much for inviting me on.
Thank you. You have an incredibly impressive resume, including several Emmy Awards, industry awards, and coverage in major news articles and magazines like the New York Times. But I want to go way back. How did trauma personally affect you, and why has it become your life's mission to chronicle stories of survival and healing through filmmaking?
Oh, that's a great question. The first thing I hear that resonates me is, how does trauma affect me and the traumas that happened to me, I guess? I had a great childhood, and everybody can pick apart their childhood and say, well, this traumatized me and that traumatized me. You know, it's just funny. I kind of laugh because my dad was a bigger than life individual, and he was a big skin diver, actually a champion skin diver. I remember him taking me out at night to go diving, and he would just go right over the side of the boat, and he had me jump in too, and in the middle of the night, in the middle of the ocean, and tend the tube. And I was telling a friend of mine this story, and she goes, well, that sounds like he was traumatizing you as a trauma. Well, you know, it's funny because it's all perspective. I think of that as it was kind of building me up. It was giving me the courage to jump into a dark ocean. So a lot of that trauma, I think, in childhood ends up being kind of perspective. The worst trauma I did, and I say I did, the first traumas were inflicted by myself. And it was inflicted by my addictions and my alcoholism and my use of drugs. And I traumatized myself through that. And up until the point where I really found a way out, I didn't think there was a way out. So I continuously kind of locked myself in a cycle. My drug of choice was alcohol. And then I used other drugs. But I traumatized myself. I put myself in positions where, by being inebriated and my drug use, that I traumatized myself. And then something happened, and again, it becomes a perspective. Mm-hmm. I was abusing alcohol very heavily, and back in June 27th, 1990, the Painted Cave fire disaster in Santa Barbara came through and took my home. And I'll get back to the perspective side of that, because there is a silver lining to that, and that, I guess, it is a trauma. Mm-hmm. You wake up one morning, and everything that you've had materially is gone, and you don't have that base anymore.
Yes.
And it took me 7 months after that fire of drinking at the fire and using drugs and being so angry. I couldn't drink enough to get drunk, and I couldn't be sober. And so I was like in a virtual purgatory. And then the woman that's my wife now actually gave me this guy's card, said Don R., and she said, go see this guy. He's found a way out of this. And if you're sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Yes.
And so I went to go see this guy, and he introduced me to a certain program. And I went, and the epiphany didn't happen right away, but I saw a lot of other people that were very similar to me. And I made a connection and identification, said, I'm not the only one that has this insane drinking problem. And everybody has their own trauma that drove them to this point of recovery. But reflecting back on the fire, without that fire, I never would have gotten sober, I don't believe, because it took me to the point where I had hit bottom. And so reflecting on it, there's a huge silver lining to that fire. I have a picture of the fire. I'm looking at it right now in my office here. Mm-hmm. I have it in my office of this huge plume of smoke. And people are like, why do you have a picture of that in here? And it's like, it reminds me sometimes the most devastating and terrible things turn out to be a silver lining, because it got me to the point where I got to my knees and I found a solution. And man, that was almost 31 years ago now. And through the grace of God and this fellowship I'm in, I haven't seen fit to have to use drugs or alcohol again. And I've produced a body of work based on trauma. And I got to say, God found an extremely effective use for those traumas and for me through that whole thing. So that's kind of the story there.
That's amazing. And as you were talking, I was thinking about, so you shared two moments in time, one from your childhood and one from the fire. And I thought to myself, I wonder if it's through your journey and healing that you look back on other moments of your childhood, whether they may have seemed, like you said, your friend mentioned, scary or traumatic, but you look at it as a positive spin on that experience. And you came out of it courageous and brave and resilient.
It's interesting because I go back to the issue of parenting and I look back at my mom and dad, and the older I get and the further I get along in my sobriety and my spiritual walk too, I guess gaining a little bit of wisdom, I look back on those times and what my parents did, and it sounds kind of cliche, but they really did do the best with what they had.
Yes.
And as time, I get kind of emotional. It was my mom's birthday, January 2nd. She's passed almost 14 years ago. But I look back on my parents, and the further I get away from that and the more I grow, the more I realize they did the best with what they had. And perhaps those times that I thought weren't fair or et cetera, it gives it a different kind of perspective. Same with jumping out of the boat in the dark. But there's other things. My dad did his best, and so did my mom. So when you're on a path and you're growing, one of my goals is I'm able to let more and more things go and understand that each individual did the best they could. And it just, to me, when you reach a certain point of adulthood and being a father, well, number one, being a husband, then a father, and a mentor for other men, you reach a certain point where you've lost the right to blame anybody for the way you are. You have to take responsibility for that. My parents and my dad was that way. I got to be honest, my dad was a practicing alcoholic and I broke that cycle. There comes a time where you have to let that go.
Yeah. And I really think once you start to have compassion for yourself, then you can start to have compassion for those around you, closest to you. And then for strangers, right? We know there are 8 billion people in the world, but if you don't love yourself first and forgive yourself and have that compassion, you're not going to have that for a stranger that you've never met. And I think, unfortunately, we're in that era of judgment and criticism, blaming and shaming, which hopefully we can reverse and get back to what humanity should really be about.
Oh my gosh, so much. And it's a spiritual axiom. You got to put on your own. Well, you got to put on your own oxygen mask before you can help somebody else. And it's like, it seems kind of selfish. Well, I have to help myself. I have to get my spiritual nutrition and take care of my spiritual health first, so then I can help others.
Yes.
And it truly is a true spiritual axiom. And it's just like, I love the analogy of when they say, put on your oxygen mask first, and then you can help others. Because if you don't do that, you're passing out and you can't be of help to anybody. Right. And I think in today's society right now and all the things that are happening, people are forgetting about doing some of the basics, and they're so outward facing and ready to blame and point fingers instead of looking at themselves. We've lost a lot of perspective that way.
Perfectly said. And speaking of others, Eric, you have made several films that focus on how trauma impacts survivors, their families, and communities, because we know it's a ripple effect. Can you please tell us about those films and what was the biggest takeaway or aha moment from each one?
Oh my gosh. I'll try to truncate this. Well, my very first film was called Faces in the Fire. My first personal film. I mean, I've done lots and lots of work for Discovery and IMAX movies, and I went through a phase of rap video. But my personal films, my very first personal film and documentary was called Faces in the Fire. And it was about the recovery after the Painted Cave fire disaster in Santa Barbara. And my biggest takeaway from that, I was very naive. I did this film almost 30 years ago now. And my biggest takeaway on that film was, and then I built a lot of other themes off of this, was that we all heal no matter who we are, gender, economic strata, no matter who we all heal in a similar way. I believe, and some people call it the universe, some people call it whatever, I believe God has made a way that we heal from trauma just like a scratch. It scabs over and there's processes and steps to it. And I believe trauma is similar that way. And that was the first time I saw that pattern, because we had interviewed so many different individuals that had survived that fire. So that was my takeaway from Facing the Fire. And it won my first Emmy Award, and it kind of got my foot in the door there. And it also revealed to me, when it was picked up by the National Institute of Mental Health, that my films have more of a worth than just entertainment, that they have a also institutional side to them, a clinical side to them. And so the National Institute of Mental Health picked up my film, and they used it to train people that were coming into disaster situations on how to debrief the survivors, et cetera, et cetera. Then my next film, which was 8 to 10 years later, my next personal film, because I had done a lot of work in between that time, and that was Homecoming, A Vietnam Vet's Journey. Mm-hmm. And that was about a motorcycle run from California to the wall in Washington, D.C. of 300 Vietnam veterans and their supporters. And it was more of a pilgrimage, a motorcycle pilgrimage. It's not really what you would picture a normal run to be. It was very spiritual and healing for these men to go all across the United States, get the welcome home that they've never received when they first came home. And then they end up at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C. And it was quite an epiphany to watch this. My takeaway from that film, again, was that we do all heal in very similar ways. But my gift from that film was an entree into the brotherhood of veterans. Mm. And I am not a veteran, but one of the biggest compliments I get when I screen my veteran-oriented films is, are you a veteran? I go, no, I'm not. And then they ask me, well, how do you know? Mm-hmm. How do you know this? And I know through my personal experience, and this is what this is what God's put me here to do. Then my next film, Searching for Home, Coming Back from War, which is my, I guess, my latest film that has been released. And you can find that on, I believe it's on Apple TV, Tubi, Vudu. If you just Google Searching for Home, Coming Back from War, you can find it. And that film, I really went to an extreme to show very diverse individuals that have went through trauma. So I had a salt of the earth veteran, Korean veteran from Kansas. And then I had a female veteran that had just served in Iraq from New York. And it's like, when we're putting that together, I'm kind of like, what do they really have in common? That's pretty diverse. That's pretty different. And I mean, all the other participants were all over the map. And I remember when I first screened that, once I had the first cut, and I'm like, oh my gosh, they all do fit together. So again, the takeaway was this diversity of people, but they all had very similar stories, even though experience was way different. Mm-hmm. The Korean War veterans' experience was Marine, Purple Heart, was very different than the female who had a military sexual trauma incident in Iraq. Mm-hmm. but they were similar. And so that leads me up to my current film, Unmasking Hope. And I'm like, okay, I want to really take this idea of this diversity to an extreme. So I've mixed up the traumas. So we have a gentleman that was sexually assaulted when he was 7 years old by somebody he trusted. Mm-hmm. We have 9/11 survivors. We have mass shooting survivors, male, female, all sorts of different ethnicities. And I really mixed it up in this one. And I'm working on it right now. And I'm seeing, even though the traumas were different, it's not just all military-oriented veteran trauma, that they too are telling the same story. Mm-hmm. It gives an overall blanket message of we do all heal the same. And what I'm going through, even though it's different, is very similar to what you may be going through. Mm-hmm. And I hope one of the final products or results of this is that it produces a certain kind of not only awareness, but tolerance.
Yes.
That people understand that the guy next to them, even though they're very, very different, they could be going through something too, and they have very, very similar reactions and emotions. So, man, I made it through the rundown of all my films.
And we can't wait to see the new one. I mean, just as you were talking, I was like, if there's a first in line or first to click or whatever, I will definitely be watching. And all of the films that you mentioned, I would love to include links in the show notes to make them accessible for the listeners.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Now, let's talk about you personally. You're an artist, a husband, a father. So therefore, you wear many, many hats. How do you prioritize and support your personal growth? And what advice do you have for people, especially dads, who feel stuck?
Oh my gosh. For me, prioritizing is very important. I kind of have my pyramid. And at the very top of that pyramid is God and sobriety. And God and sobriety and my spirituality. I remember somebody once told me, I was talking about my sobriety and my fellowship that I'm in. And I'm like, well, the spiritual side. And he goes, well, the spiritual side of your sobriety is just like the round side of the basketball. Mm-hmm. It all goes together. So at the top of that pyramid, you know, I have to put God and sobriety and my spiritual health in that, the top of the pyramid. Then comes my wife. And I was once told that you want to show your kids that you love them, then love their mother.
Yes.
That was key. And sometimes I got to admit, and a lot of guys out there, it's not always the easiest thing. It's mm-hmm. kind of like, well, don't you put your children first? No, for me, I really have to put my wife first and everything else falls into place, you know, our whole household. And then comes my kids. Mm-hmm. And being a father comes way before, for me, before being an artist and a filmmaker. And I'm just so blessed and I'm super proud of all three of my kids and where they've ended up. And I have the perfect parenting partner in my wife. If it was just me doing this, the kids would have turned out a little bit lopsided. And if it was just her doing it, it would have been. But they seem to be doing really well. And then underneath that comes my work. And then comes all the stuff I love to do. I love going to films. I love surfing. I love the ocean and all that stuff. But as far as a real practical tip in that, asking for help is like one of the most important things, I think. And I'm 58 years old, and we talked about this before the interview. I see a lot of couples that have had their kids. They're all grown up, and I see a lot of divorce, and mm-hmm. I see a lot of men chasing things that are very of this world. And hey, don't get me wrong. I love having nice things, a nice car. I'm all about my paddle boards and my surfboards and getting really cool things, but that can dominate you. And I have to put my priority into order there. And how do I do that? I have to ask for help. And if things are out of bounds with my drinking, I'm coming up on 31 years sober, but I still have to ask for help. I still have to go to my group. I still have to do all of that. And if I run into a problem that I don't understand, I need to find somebody else that's maybe walked that path. And that comes to one of my number one things is for the past 31 years, I've had a mentor, and they're older than me. They're a man that follows God, and I allow them to speak into me, which is very different than having somebody speak to you. It just, I accept what they say to me, and it's a very formalized relationship. And I have breakfast with my mentor once a week. And we just kind of go over things. He's 86 years old and he's a man that follows God. And he's, holy cow, I think he's 56 years sober also.
Amazing.
So he's similar to me. He knows where I am walking and he's been there. And I allow him to speak into me. And I think I have a hard time making decisions on my own as a man. And I kind of revert to the 12-year-old in me quite often, but I'm learning how not to do that and how not to be selfish. And that helps to have somebody to bounce things off of. And I think I really feel that if all men in this situation were to have a more formalized mentor relationship, a lot of these problems might not come up because you need to hear from somebody that's been through it before. So I feel strongly about that.
That's beautiful. And I think who you surround yourself with, we're not just talking about recipe for professional success, but for personal success. So having that solid foundation, a safe space where you can go to, like you said, ask for help, ask questions, and feel like you're going to receive compassion and empathy and love and support. I think then it allows you to be able to take risks in other places in your life and still have that place to come back to when things feel out of sorts.
Exactly. And that's finding your tribe. Mm-hmm. And I have my tribe, and my tribe has meetings all over the world now. And I can go anywhere and walk into that room, and we all have a connection to being alcoholics and drug addicts in recovery. And my biggest heroes are not necessarily the guys that somehow amassed more stuff and more money. I mean, that's, I can go into that. That's one thing. But my biggest heroes are the men that have faced their own demons and have come out on top of that and are in a continuing program or a continuing lifestyle of growth. And that's the guys that I look at and are my heroes.
Beautiful. So big takeaway message for the men listening, especially find your tribe, right? And find people that are on the same journey as you, not necessarily alike, but you're all on this journey together. And you can support each other along the way.
And ask for help.
And ask for help.
Find somebody that has what you want to have in a spiritual way. And then say, hey, why don't we go to a coffee or something? Then start to ask some questions. And a lot of times, most men that are in that position and spiritually developed like that are more than happy to pass it on, because we find out when we pass it on, because I have guys that call me their mentor. Mm-hmm. And when I'm able to pass it on to them, I actually get more than I believe than they're getting, because I get to give it away now.
Right. Pass the torch.
Yep.
Yeah. And so switching back to filmmaking, you connect with and interview trauma survivors, but that takes a very specific skill set. In your opinion, what skills have been the most helpful to you in your experience?
Life. What I have went through, I'm always reluctant to say the traumas I went through, but that's true. What I've went through and the life I've went through, that becomes very, very important. And the recovery, I understand what it's like to struggle and to try to change something, to try to overcome something that seems that it's so embedded in you. I completely understand that. That's one of the skills, is having been there. I'm still in recovery. Mm-hmm. So I understand these people and the participants in my film that are recovering and working through this. It's a different thing and a different kind of recovery than mine, but it's still very, very similar. Then the other skill set is empathy. And I don't know if that's a skill. I'd like to call it a skill set, is practicing empathy, being able to fully put yourself in somebody else's shoes. And part of that skill set is truly hearing what somebody's saying. And when I go into an interview, I've surfed my whole life. I call it surfing with them. Once we're on the same wavelength and I've opened up, I'm just a channel for them. And then we start to connect, that I can literally feel their emotions and go with them to where they're going. And once we get into that, and that's true empathy, because you're really connecting with that other person, trying to put yourself and being just totally open and being clear for them. And somebody was telling me that They call it holding space. You hold that space for that person to speak with you. And it's a really good tool to have. And I try to practice it with my wife. But it's a little bit more difficult with people close to you.
Yes.
Because there's so many buttons installed and emotions and things like that. So if you were to really run that down, it's life experience and having been there and understand it from the insider's point of view. And then the other part is the empathy and truly listening and being able to project yourself into their position and let them know that when they're telling their story to you, that you're fully understanding what they're saying and you're with them, which is very different than just listening to somebody speak.
Yes, love that. And so historically, we know there has been lots of shame and silence tied to trauma, but through filmmaking and conversations that you're putting out there, the narrative is starting to change in the way people think and talk about collective trauma. How do you think this is being done? And where do you see the future of all of this going?
I think the key is two words, empathy and tolerance. And that's brought about through awareness. And with my films, I tell the stories of these very diverse individuals, but there's always places that the viewer can connect with. Even though I'm not a veteran, he was able to overcome this and he was able to recover. He was able to come home and get on with his life, but he needed help. But for me, the viewer, they may not be a veteran, but they may have obstacles that are very similar. So they connect that way. Then it becomes empathy and a connection with the film. So what I'm trying to put out there is these very diverse stories where people can connect, and then it produces empathy for the individuals, which then creates for the viewer a feeling that, wow, I'm very similar, even though these people are so different than me. And then it produces a certain amount of tolerance, hopefully. Then that will kind of an aura effect that will spread out into other parts of their life when they're in a situation, say, in the supermarket or something,
and, yes,
and somebody snaps at them or somebody honks at them or whatever. Or there's some sort of situation and they go, you know what? Try to remember that those people are very similar and they have something else going on in their life that could be very similar to me, and give them that little bit of tolerance. Mm-hmm. And then on a bigger picture, it goes into, there's whole sectors of society and whole like belief systems and things that we're so intolerant about. And when we realize that we're all in this together, that we all heal the same, that we all go through these traumas and situations in a very similar way, that it produces, again, this tolerance and understanding that maybe we should take the time to try to reach out or take the personal time to take that thought and that time to understand these people, because we're all the same. Mm-hmm. Basically, and through that, it produces tolerance. Mm-hmm. We're so into making a snap judgment about certain things and seeing things in black and white so quickly. And if we would just take the time to step back and use a little bit of empathy, put ourselves in other people's shoes, and a little bit of awareness, and produce some tolerance, and then understand that maybe making a judgment on somebody that's based on one or two sentences is not really correct, because there's so much gray area. Mm. And I feel strongly about that.
That's great, which actually answered one of my next questions, but I wasn't sure if it's a straightforward answer or it's a difficult one to answer. And that's about the silver lining from the pandemic in terms of collective trauma.
Oh my gosh. I wish I could easily see that. Mm-hmm. And that just brings up for me a shortcoming for myself, is that I need to step back a little bit and not be so judgy about the different sides and everything coming up in this. And so as far as the collective trauma and a silver lining to this, man, I really struggle with that, because it's just so divisive.
Yes.
And it seems like common sense has gotten politicized. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I think this whole pandemic has done is make us more aware of smaller things and how important that is, and the connection, and how important connection is, and even to the point of physical connection. When it got really bad, my meetings went to Zoom. Mm-hmm. And that not be able to be in the same room with others, it's so in human nature to want to connect and be in proximity to others. And I think if anything, it's really emphasized the importance of that human aspect of us to want to connect and want proximity and want a physical presence. And on the negative side of that, with people that already had mental health issues and things like that, the prescription for the pandemic is isolation, but it's antithesis of what the mental health, the person that's suffering through mental health problems, it's the antithesis of what their personal prescription is. But going back to the silver lining, I hope it just makes us all aware that the importance of human connection, physical proximity, and the value of that.
Yes, and how it could impact us if we don't have it. Because I think globally, we've all seen that suffering.
Oh, yes. Yeah, man, it makes me realize that I still have a lot of growth. We're so in the middle of this still. Mm-hmm. And I even see the different sides in my own family with my kids and the divisiveness. Because my daughter is on one side and my son is definitely way on the other side. And it's just tough to see. So,
and I think media is a big part of that. I'd hate to just blame one particular platform, but we know a lot of people are online, they're getting direct messaging, and that's influencing their opinions and attitudes and behavior. So I hope at least the positive side of media are through things that you're doing. So more connectedness, more empathy, rather than polarization and divisiveness.
And that's where one of my pillars is squarely in telling the human story and not getting politicized and including the hope.
Yes.
And not just telling the story about the problem, but telling the story about the hope. And in putting together Unmasking Hope, which is obviously hope is a huge part of the film, is sometimes it's difficult to tell the story. It's easy to sometimes tell the story just about the problem. This is what's up. This is like the biggest problem. It's just with the veterans returning home. This is the problem, etc. It's like finding the stories of hope. That's where I plant my pillar of my films. All my films have to include the hope. And it's always interesting when I'm in the edit suite and I look at the first cut, I always have the incident and I guess what you would say the problem is always way too long. And I have to cut that part back and make sure the hope really, really is the center of the film because the world needs hope. And through this pandemic, we need the hope.
Yeah.
Where I'm battling such a big media machine of despair and that wants to break down the hope. Mm-hmm. It seems like every turn there's something else. And honestly, if we just unplug for a while and realize what is just around ourselves, we're okay. Mm-hmm. Again, it goes back to that thing that I was talking about at the very beginning. It's a question of perspective.
Yes. Yes. And it matters too where you get that perspective versus forming your own. A lot of influence out there, that's for sure. Okay, Eric, can you please share with the listeners what you've learned along your parenting journey?
One of the biggest things I think my wife and I, because I always include her, I mean, she's my perfect parenting partner. I think it's 50-50. My kids would have been one way and too far one way if it was just me. And then they would have been one way and too far one way if it was just her. So we just meet in the middle. But what my wife and I were able to do, I think, that was the most important thing. And this is the analogy I use when I talk to other parents, and particularly other dads, is we've created a wide open pasture. But on the edges of that pasture are these really gnarly electric fences. We don't sweat all the small stuff. We've tried to create an environment and instill in them a love of learning and a love of being passionate about something over, say, just a goal-oriented kind of form of parenting. And my one boy, he's graduating from Harvard this year, and we are not the parents that said, our kids are going to go to Harvard, and this. That was never really the goal. Mm-hmm. The goal with my wife and I was to instill in them a love of learning and wonder around the learning, but also find your passion and whatever you're passionate about. And I told the kids this multiple times, whatever you're passionate about and you prove you're passionate about, we're going to support 100%. And it's very different than saying, well, I want you to get a scholarship, a D1 football scholarship, and go to a college. And this is the college. We got to get into Berkeley. The goal-oriented for me, it just something gets lost. And I think on the other side of that, even if they do achieve the goal, then this kind of empty. With my three kids and my daughter in particular, she's very passionate about LGBTQ. She's very passionate about body positive. And she's a plus-size model that's becoming very successful. And I think a lot of that, what's behind that is it wasn't necessarily a goal. if you would have told me my daughter in junior high was going to be a model, mm-hmm. I would have been like, no, I don't think so. But it became part intrinsic to like her passion, what the story she wants to tell. So, and it's very similar with my boy that ended up playing football over at Harvard, is that he's passionate about football and he's passionate about learning. And so is my older boy. And so what I'm saying is basically it's instilling kind of a bigger overall thought process and love of life and learning and being passionate about something. And my wife and I both have had our own businesses, and I've been a filmmaker for for a long time. And they see us being passionate about our life and being passionate about what we do and passionate about each other. So it's a big gift we've been given. And it's amazing to see the kids be able to grow up in that huge pasture with their boundaries, very, very on the sides, very clear cut, but being able to thrive, though, and create that environment for them.
Yes. And I think with this generation of children, really that follow your passion means more than ever before. Because the way I always think about is we don't want a generation of middle, older adults who are unhappy and unfulfilled. So if we can start that earlier, well, we're giving them the best gift possible.
It is true where they say, follow your passion and then your economics will follow. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that happen. And you build a life around that. And it could be whatever it is. It could be banking. It could be modeling. It could be writing for my older boy. So.
And are there any books or movies that are transformational that were for you as a parent that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, there's a great film, and you probably have to Google it. It's called A Race to Nowhere. And it's an older film, and it's about the race to nowhere is that elusive getting the ACT score, getting into that one school you got and focusing on that. And it really does lay bare the fallacy of that whole idea, because that kind of environment and that goal-oriented environment, and you have to get this at any cost, it produces cheating. It produces, mm-hmm. well, we saw that with yes. the whole college.
Yes, admission scandal.
Exactly. And it produces something that's so goal-oriented, it's not core. And what my wife and I have tried to do, and we seem to have done, is create like a core of passion for what they want to do. But yeah, Race to Nowhere is a really, really good film.
Beautiful. And also include a link for that in the show notes as well.
Great.
Thank you so much, Eric. There's some parenting wisdom from... Well, I'm going to call you an expert, because it's really all about raising great kids who are fulfilled and happy and doing things that they love. So you've been successful in that regard, and you're a role model for parents such as myself with younger kids. And Eric, where can our listeners find out more about you?
Let's see. If you want to find out about me personally, you can go to ecproductions.com. That's EC, Eric Christensen, ecproductions.com. And then if you want to find out more about the film, you can go to unmaskinghopethemovie.com and also Unmasking Hope on Instagram and Facebook and also on TikTok. I've been doing some TikToks about the post-production process on this film.
And I really want to end with, I know this is a quote that you had shared on another podcast as it being your favorite quote, and it's by Ralph Waldo Emerson. And to quote him, to know even one life has breathed easier because you have lived, that is to have succeeded. And you've certainly done that, Eric.
Well, thank you so much. And that actually, one of the first times I heard that was from J.R. Franklin. And he had quoted that in my film, Homecoming, A Vietnam Vet's Journey. He was a Vietnam vet, and he's one of my heroes. And so now Ralph Waldo Emerson is a big hero of mine, and a Harvard grad, too.
Yes, and now we'll all be quoting you as well.
Thank you.
And to the listeners, thank you for tuning in. Until next time. Thank you for listening to the Baby Steps Nutrition Podcast with your host, Argavan Neelforush. We hope you enjoyed our deep dive into all the tips and tricks you and your family can use to make daily life a little easier. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the podcast, please leave a rating and review, share with others, and follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Baby Steps Nutrition Podcast. As always, you can head over to babystepsnutrition.com to sign up for our email list, as well as check out all the links and resources in the show notes. See you next time. Tune in. Feel great.